The Vox Markets Podcast.
Welcome to Hot Stocks Live here with Paul Hill. Of course, Paul is an equity analyst, full-time investor. He never sleeps. He's always on the markets. The markets are open. In fact, even if the markets aren't open, Paul's awake. You know, fella.
Yeah, good afternoon, Justin. Slightly different timing for us normally, but it was important today because it was straight after the Bank of England decision of at 12 o'clock. In fact, I did see Andrew Bailey listen to what you've been telling him to do for the last 2 or 3 months, is to hold rates. So you got your prize.
Yeah, well, I was surprised at that. Like I said, we were covering it live, John and I, on Taking Stock, and I was expecting, you think, as a sensible banker, economist, whatever he is, I don't know what qualifications he has, but you'd think they'd go with market forecasts. But those forecasts have changed, didn't they? Almost yesterday, after CPI data came out, it was like the majority of people was going for a quarter percentage point hike. And then all of a sudden, after CPI data came out, 50-50 pretty much, saying it's going to be a pause. And I think, what have they got inside information there somewhere? Why would you just change overnight on that data? I don't know if they did change overnight, but it was a close call, 5-4 on the vote, wasn't it, on the MPC?
Yeah. I think what's quite interesting, though, if you look at it from a macro perspective, we had the Federal Reserve making a similar decision the day before, and they've taken a sort of hawkish pause stance. But what they did was upgrade their economic projections going forward, and therefore they think they're going to hold rates higher for longer. So rather than start cutting next year and end the year December 24 at sort of 4.5%, they're going to keep it to just over 5% in 18 months' time in December 24. So you've got the US economy really motoring, and therefore, you're going to have higher rates and more restrictive monetary policy for longer. But actually, the reason for Andrew Bailey reducing, I'm pretty sure, is that he thinks is actually the economic scenario is much weaker this side of the Atlantic, which basically means that he's going to start having to hold and then cut interest rates probably sooner than the most investors expected. And I know we've been sort of discussing that the last two calls, that effectively I thought that the interest rates on the States were going to stay higher for longer than the Wall Street were expecting. But I thought actually in the UK is suspicion that we will start cutting beforehand. So I can actually see, because unemployment's going up faster, certainly in the UK than it is in the US, then I can actually see, inflation's going to continue in its downward trajectory now. Andrew Bailey's going to get a bit of pressure from the government from Westminster, because we're going to have a general election in November 24. There's going to be a bit of pressure for him to start cutting, and I can actually see him doing that probably around about March or the end of the second quarter, sort of like between March and June, which will be sort of 3 to 6 months sooner than the market's baking in, and that will be good for obviously economically cyclical stocks. And obviously, people like the house builders as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, the house builders, we do quite well. That there, by the way, is on the chart. There is pound, dollar. You can see, last few months, the pound has been coming down against the dollar. Yeah, yeah. And I you know, this is a good chart. I was looking at just house builders had a nice rally, I think, last week. And this is like Gleason's chart. MJ Gleason, smaller house builder. And like I said, it hit the lows back in October here, also in January, December, and then it has been quite volatile. But even the previous lows have been higher than the last ones, and we've had so much gloomy news out on house builders that you'd think it would go lower, but it hasn't. And that's a good sign, isn't it? Very good sign. And So I'm thinking maybe Bailey. There's some kind of a data point. I don't think it was that CPI data that made it change his mind. I think it's more like you said there, the economy is weakening. I said, yes, see a recession coming, and he doesn't want to be blamed for that. But that's what they're trying to do, essentially, slow everything down. They need to. How can you slow everything down without not going into recession when the growth, GDP growth is minimal, if anything, isn't it? It's flat, basically,
Yeah. I mean, you put yourself in the position of Rishi Sunak and Philip Hunt, the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. Then they're going to have an election in just over 12 months' time. The last thing they want to do that is start actually going to the hustings and trying to actually defend a recession or a deep recession. So Andrew Bailey, basically, I'm pretty sure now, is going to hold and the economic data is going to weaken, and he's going to be coming under huge amounts of sort of like, you know, nudging and pressure to actually start cutting early next year, and you'll start seeing that in the unemployment, no doubt about it, as people begin losing their jobs, unfortunately. So I'm with you. But the big picture is such that if we've reached a bottom in the house builders because they're economically sensitive and particularly interest rate sensitive, then I think we can go ditto small caps, good quality small caps. The multiples, you're going to see expansion of the multiples in small caps from extremely oversold levels to back to norm, to mean reversion. I don't think you're going to see huge amounts of EPS growth, as in, like, you know, increasing higher EPS outcome than actually built into expectations. But I can certainly see a big tick up in multiple expansion for the small cap. So for me and you, this could actually be a seminal moment.
Yeah. Well, listen, we are here live. To give you an example, is 3:50, 50 seconds gone. And so if you want to ask us a question or Paul a question, because I know we've already got a question in, it's on a very popular stock, CEO of a company you've interviewed this week, but it is about Avacta. It's like I said, very popular stock. But if you want to ask Paul any questions about stocks he holds or stocks he's talked about previously, let him know in the comment section right there. And while you're there, hit that like and subscribe button if you could. But Jacob says, hi, given the news out on Avacta and the huge potential markets ahead of it, I'd like to know what you see as the key risks from here for investors. Now, actually, you had a chat with the main guy there. Is he feeling bullish, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously they came out with really important and very exciting data for their cohort 6 and the phase 1A AVA 6000 chemo warhead clinical trial, basically saying that the safety profile is absolutely top notch. In fact, it's so good they're going to a cohort 7 to get the maximum tolerated dose. But also, and this was really, incredible, they started to see that efficacy was also was working, and they had one particular patient, very sick patient with soft tissue sarcoma, that saw a significant, and this is what he said, significant shrinkage in that tumor. Now, what that means to me, and this is what he said as well, is essentially the whole precision platform and the FAP activated drug, etc., is working absolutely as it's designed. It's not only stopping toxicity getting into the healthy tissues into around about the heart, but it's also actually starting to shrink tumors. And I know it's only a small sample of 35, and so one of the big risks that I would say is that when you scale it up to phase 2 and potentially phase 3 and you get to hundreds, then you might start seeing other issues come forward, etc. But assuming that's not the case, then this is absolutely out of this world. It's better than the company expectations, I'm sure, when they went into the actual trial, to not only get significant safety, data that is frankly leading edge, but they're also starting to see efficacy coming through as well. And that really does set it up for the phase 2. In fact, what it means is that because they're in such a good, confident and strong position, they can then just do a small additional study and skip the phase 1B they'd already planned, saving time and saving cost, for the business, and hopefully bring the actual drug itself to patients who desperately need this treatment sooner than they're anticipated. And I think they're aiming for to start the phase. It's a pivotal phase 2 trial the back end of next year, which will be split between the US and the UK. And what is really, really exciting, Singers have put a note out in terms of what they think, the valuation of the business. And I think it's just over £1.50, et cetera. But that's a risk adjusted. And if you look at it for, they've got, I think it's a 37.5%, probability that AVA 6000 makes it to market. Well, actually, that could be a lot, lot better than 37.5%, given what we've seen so far. So, if that comes to market, you're well over double that target they put down. And that's just the one drug. They've got precision. They've got, there's a whole host of others they could do for different existing chemotherapies that are FAP enzyme activated with other tumors as well. So this could really be, you know, a game. It's game-changing results, no doubt about it. The thing is not to get too excited this early, but it's looking really, really good. Not only, you know, for the actual product, for the AVA 6000 and the precision platform, but also for patients, the outlook. I mean, these are desperately sick patients that, frankly, have no alternative other than, unfortunately, they're going to die because they really are in desperate need of something that's going to be able to help them get through, because they've probably got metastatic cancers, etc. And this could well be, you know, the platform that helps them do it affordably and across the world.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, the data so far is very good and it's very encouraging. But I mean, just, and what I love about investing is you learn about sectors. You learn, you know, before I started investing, I knew very little about clinical trials, but I've looked at them and read about them, look at the stats on them. And like I say, you know, phase one, pretty much it's about safety, you know, and that's the most important thing of all. You know, can patients take this drug without any adverse reactions to it, effects to it, you know, the killing people essentially. It's less than 50 people. But as it goes along, phase two, the amount of patients goes up and the risk goes up. But of course, if you pass those, then the valuation goes up as well, because the potential going to market is higher. And then phase three, I mean, I'd say, if you look at the stats, very few companies fail on phase one, you know, but quite a few fail on phase three, because thousands of people, or even several hundred or thousands of people. And so it's very costly as well. And it's a lot more complex. It's about, you know, beating competitors, market competitors out there and all that stuff. So, yeah.
This is what's really interesting. Yeah. We know that the standard doxorubicin, because this is pro-doxorubicin, it's a pro-drug format. The standard doxorubicin, it's been in operation. It's not patented anymore. It's been used by patients in chemotherapy for 30 years, 25. My mum used it basically, and it didn't work because, unfortunately, the toxicity, you know, she had to stop because it was killing. But we do know it knocks 10 bells out of cancers. It just unfortunately knocks 10 bells out of health tissue as well. So efficacy is not the issue with these chemotherapies drugs. It's just side effects. Okay, and that's the key. So when you're on your model, you go from safety ticking the box on phase one. They've actually got some very good efficacy data as well. Phase two is the pivotal efficacy study, and it's going to be on obviously more patient to see whether you are actually seeing a significant shrinkage of the tumor without causing any more side effects on more on people. And we haven't seen any significant side effects at all in any of them. So that's been absolutely brilliant. And therefore, phase three, it obviously depends on what the regulatory authorities want to do. But we know, doxorubicin is very, very, you know, effective at what it does, what it says on the tin. It's protecting the patient. And if you've demonstrated that in phase one and phase two, then you're probably not going to have to do a really long and really advanced study in phase three. And that may well be accelerated. So the risk from the traditional model, because you're using an existing drug, is a lot lower.
So the safety profile is well known, I suppose. Yeah. Okay. And just chart wise, it's looking quite good. You know, it's gone up above that 200-day moving average, and it hasn't that for a while. Like I said, that level there does seem to be very good support of that sort of pound level. But it's lifting up this nicely. So
let's be clear about it. Yeah, there's masses and masses of big cancer, you know, biopharma companies out there, just, you know, Novartis, Roche, GSK, all these kind of guys. Yeah. And some of them have really big sort of chemotherapy franchises, et cetera. Now they need to replenish those pipelines. All I'm saying is that if they can get good data by the end of this first phase, then that gives them a huge amount of optionality about what they want to do. Then they can either self-fund it. And if they're getting a lot of interest from commercial big pharma who want to put a lot of money into it, they could obviously, you know, use some of that finance if they want to, but it's their call. Now, you could also see, and this is what you talk about the share price, it wouldn't be surprising that, you know, if we as laymen are looking at these results thinking they're absolutely tremendous, then you can guarantee the best scientists in the world are also looking at this, and they won't want somebody else buying it before they get a chance to put a number on it.
Yeah, but maybe they would. I assume, like, the thing is, when like the partnership, it's a very well known model. You know, what you do is prove out as much data as you can afford to do with the time you got to do it, and then de-risk it for bigger pharma companies, and then they come in and will, you know, snap it up. Or in fact, you know, a company I hold, like I said, Destiny Pharma, come up with interims this week, and the new CEO stepped in, Chris Tovey, who's a very experienced guy, and he basically said, you know, the reason why I came into Destiny Pharma is because I've never known these assets are fantastic. They, you know, serve a huge unmet medical need serving people, you know, all different sort of diseases and antimicrobial resistance. And he said, you know, and he said, last time I was in a company like this, in fact, he said, Destiny Pharma is a better placed asset wise than GW Pharma was when I started there. And it's 6 months after he started GW Pharma, he's taken that for $7.2 billion.
Yeah.
So it depends. And in fact, let me just share the screen. If you look at that, you know, the phase, they've got like phase two, they're going to phase three for their, it's a big drug, $2 billion US market opportunity there. They've also got M3, which is in phase, going to phase three, and that's funded by Symbolic Pharmaceuticals. And that's what they did. You know, you take lots of data up until phase three. Phase three is very expensive, and then you partner it with somebody else. But they've also got this pipeline here, which is, you know, thing. But I was really impressed. I did watch his interview. Hopefully he's going to be on the podcast very soon, Chris Tovey, but really impressed with him. And it's funny. He said, why? Somebody did ask, why have you come to Destiny Pharma, a microcap? You know, and he said, well, essentially, because the assets they have. And, so it's very thing, yeah. But
one of their partners could buy it if they get good results. You know, it would be a stupid decision, would it? And you know, they've got all the clinical data, and therefore they can price it and put in the relevant risks associated getting it final clearance. Then they could be a very attractive asset for a much bigger pharmaceutical company that needs growth.
Yeah.
One thing on healthcare, etc. I know, because do you still own Intelligent Ultrasound?
Yeah, I mean, you just bought them.
Okay, I was going to pick your brain then.
In fact, someone did say, by the way, this question here, Steve said, Intelligent Ultrasound could be an opportunity. I've done my own research and agree. Just wanted if you could share your thoughts. Thanks. Go on.
Great,
my
brain. Well,
I may not know the answer.
Yeah, well, the question that I had, which came over the news wires this morning, so I'm hoping you've seen it, but you may not. If you haven't, I'll send it to you. But GE Healthcare, okay, have just got a $44 million grant from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to develop AI ultrasound technology to help third world countries, you know, to improve their, they don't need, you know, so expensive doctors. Yeah. They can go ahead with it. Now, what the sort of the question is, I mean, that should be in theory very positive for Intelligent Ultrasound, because that means that, you know, essentially they're getting their customer who's developing, effectively helping to develop Intelligent Ultrasound's AI capability, is getting $44 million $44 million to be able then to accelerate it. So I was just wondering.
Yeah.
It seems positive to me.
Yeah, well, I've just got it there. So $44 million.
Yeah.
Wow. They're just going to buy Intelligent Ultrasound, aren't they?
So they've got $44 million now to do it.
I know. This is very funny because, like I say, you know, they, three of the machines, they've got three products now, Intelligent Ultrasound, that have AI, and they've got 37 million images they use backed up from that. They've been developing this for over 5-6 years now. So, and they are, you know, first, they're a leader in this field. And this is why GE pretty much uses them and uses their products. So that's very interesting. Yeah, very interesting.
That's what I thought.
But I said, they're going to be, and what I like about it is, like, their steady sort of backbone to the business currently is seminars, and they teach people how to use ultrasound machines in simulators, and then they follow them through the clinic, and obviously they sell into the clinic as well. But the AIs, so the backbone, the simulation business, is, you know, doing around about I think plus 10 million in revenue this year. And they say, but in a couple of years' time, they'll probably be doing sort of 12, 13 million. But the AI side will also be doing the same. Now, when you understand last year, the AI side only did 300,000, but yet they're still, you know, they're still monetizing AI even last year. It's doubled to 700,000, and it'll double again, and it'll double until it gets 13 million again by, or 12 and a half million by 2025, because they now have the AI products in three products, which they didn't before. It was only one product, now it's in three, and they're increasingly using it. Like GE accounts for 50% of the world's ultrasound machines, so you can't get a bigger customer, so it's huge for them.
And also the thing is this grant from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is targeted at low or middle income countries. So what you're doing is actually, because you've got that AI, intelligent layer over, helping assistants and doctors diagnose and to treat, patients and people obviously who are, going through labour, in the maternity wards, etc. Then what it's doing is that you're increasing expanding the addressable market hugely, because you've got so much of the world who can't afford this technology still, unfortunately. But with this particular bit of, overlay of AI, it allows them then to start using this leading edge, medical science. And so you're increasing your global market for ultrasound. So it's got to be positive. Yeah. It's got to be a win-win either way, I think.
Look at this. This here. So it says, grant from Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation with less experience to perform quick and accurate ultrasound scans to help address maternal and fetal health respiratory. This is essentially, that scan that is that. GE's, this is intelligent ultrasound. That's their website, and that's GE using it. So that's phenomenal. Yeah, wow.
That's breaking news then, I suppose.
Yeah, breaking news, yeah. Now, the share price goes up, but
I don't know, you have to buy some more. But anyway, that's public information, because it was done on the 18th, wasn't it? So 2 or 3 days ago.
Yeah. Okay, someone says, by the way, HVivo, have you been looking at those? Because someone did say it seems to be steadily climbing over the past few weeks. Good to see a little bit more trading volume as late. Thoughts on progress and the company itself would be useful. I am invested. Dave, that is. Dave, I do like
HVivo. I'm in the same party as John. I'm a big fan. Yeah. I don't own shares of HVivo. But this is a very much a sort of captured market. People think that it's easy to replicate. It absolutely isn't, because you've got to have really strong, procedures to make sure you get the right dosing regimes for people. And, they don't just give out, the authorities don't just give out licenses to people to do, vaccine challenge trials, because it can be highly dangerous. So this has to be a very controlled environment. And, from what I've, a number of fund managers I've spoken to, they really sort of rate the CEO who's done this before as well, with regards to contract research organizations. And I don't know. I mean, it's difficult for me, but I would say the path of least resistance for the share price is going to be up, because this is only relatively a small company. But in a huge market, and vaccines are becoming far more important as a form of, therapeutics and treatment. Just look at cancer, the amount of vaccines now being, and that money being piled into it, from Moderna and from Pfizer to be able to do that, because they realize one of the best ways is to use your T cells to be able to attack the cancers and shrink them. And these guys are going to be right in it.
Yeah. Well, look at that chart. It's a nice looking chart, that. I mean, if you look at the red line, just the 200 moving average, let's take the 50 off for a second. But if you look at the 200 moving average, and you see it's just downtrend, it breaks that literally, Be careful of fast rises. They can get sold into, like this there, 21st of November, got sold into there, but then it picked up again. Another fast rise can get sold into, but now bounced back on the 200 moving average. It's using that as support pretty much, and now it's rising up nicely. A nice steady climb. So that's quite nice. And John, owns some of these. And he said, John likes the areas of picks and shovels of big industry. And it's very clever, because they'll always have work. These companies, if they're good, they'll always get work. Like I said, you can go for the sort of the sexier end, which is actually creating kind of vaccines and all that, but that's high risk. But these guys will always be in work. And like I say, if you're very good at it, that they are, then, look at that. Nothing's not like there. Revenue grew 52%, EBITDA more than doubled, even net cash got up to 31 from 15, and contract book 78 million.
Picks and shovels models are great, no doubt about it, because you're not betting on any particular person winning, you're going to win anyway, But what I really like about the business is that the demand is off the charts. And so much so, they're having to bring in new capacities. They've got that, they've just raised some, or they've got some money to basically put on a new facility and bring extra beds to be able to do these challenges. So demand is just not an issue. Demand is off the charts on this, and you can see that coming through. The only limiting factor is capacity, which is great.
Yeah, exactly. Okay,
another one in exactly the same boat, is Bella Scura. And I know we've talked about that. They came out with interim results, but essentially, you know, big picture, the shares have sold off a bit because it's going to be more second half weighted. But essentially, investors should look at it, and these do, you know, the portable oxygen concentrators that help COPD patients, etc. But essentially, they've got FDA approval. They've got best-in-class distributors, you know, like McKesson. They've got established supply chain in the likes of, you know, China and locally manufactured in the States. And the demand here is off the charts again. They've got a new product coming out very shortly in Q4 of, you know, next month or so. The Discover portable oxygen concentrator. They're taking, we know, $15 million worth of new contracts. You've got Inomax, their partner out in the States, which is a subsidiary of Foxconn. They've actually got a license, you know, for exclusive of, you know, $55 million. I mean, that's the key when you come to this sort of, like, you know, really, you know, really proprietary and sort of, like, you know, in-demand technology, is do customers like it? And they don't just like it. They absolutely just can't get enough of it. So the issue for, you know, hVIVO, but more so for Bella Scura, is going to be execution and meeting that demand. So who knows? But all I can say is that the product is fabulous because very, very sensible and professional people in the industry are signing up, and they can't get enough volume. So that says to me that this thing is their product is definitely state of the art. And the same is with hVIVO. They just aren't. It's literally, you've got a shed load of customers trying to buy from one party. So it gives you huge confidence and revenue visibility as long as you can deliver. And that's where, you know, basically now they've got the supply chain in place and the distribution partners to be able to get that.
Yeah. Do you know what?
2024 is going to be an inflection point for the business. You mark my words.
Yeah. It rallied quite strongly. It's back, you know, there. But I mean, there's six or higher lows there. I can't stop thinking about that intelligent ultrasound.
sorry about that. I should have said it at the end, shouldn't I?
No, because I just think, you know, GE, as you, you know, use their AI technology. I mean, if they're going to submit a way of, you know, spread that around the world in an affordable way, they're not going to create, you know, the technology themselves. They're going to sort of obviously get in contact with the best people they know, I suppose, they're contracts with. Who knows? Anyway, but that's a very bullish.
All I would say is that your thesis is spot on there, Justin, because, you know, Bill and Melinda Gates aren't stupid, okay? They don't throw money around. And if they believe that you know, GE Healthcare AI system powered by intelligent ultrasound is the one to go for, you can get a lot of, gives you a lot of, you know, sort of confidence. But I would say, you know, that needs to be confirmed by the company, and it's still early days, because if they've only just given them the grant, then that will have to come through in the fullness of time. It isn't as though it's anything announceable in the next few weeks, because you know, they won't see that because they've probably only just got the money.
Yeah.
But it's got to be positive, you'd have thought.
Yeah, talking about healthcare, someone did say about Totally PLC, and they've had a horrendous time. I mean, the chart here, do you see it's come down? And they did say that expectations are going to be lower in a statement recently. And it's hard, the NHS is hard going, there's cuts going on, but they're the front line there. And, you know, pretty results. I mean, turnover thing, revenue up was $137 million. This was to 12 months, 31st of March. They did give a bit of a profit warning, but nevertheless, they're profitable. And so, you know, EBITDA, $7 million. But now the valuation on these, they are a dramatic cap of $15 million. Yeah. When you get companies so oversold like this, I mean, you know, sentiment drives and sellers beget sellers. And regardless sometimes of the value, people just get out. And that can present some great opportunities, but someone's asking about
I haven't been following them, but you're exactly right. I mean, I've spoken to Wendy Lawrence a couple of times, the CEO, and she's absolutely terrific. I mean, she comes from, you know, the healthcare area, and I'm not sure she's a doctor, but she's certainly, you know, best in class when it comes to sort of the servicing the NHS. And Yeah, I mean, that looks a ridiculous price to me. And let's be clear about it. You know, a lot of the difficulties they've had, I think, has been, you know, recruitment and getting the right number to be able to help the NHS. And if we do see a slackening off in the labour market, then that all actually it's just a transitory, in inverted commas, issue. And therefore, you know, in the fullness of times, it will come through. So there's lots of companies are going through some difficulties. But the share price is pricing them to death, and this isn't anywhere near it. It absolutely isn't anywhere near it. It looks like a crazily low multiple for a business that's a bit of essential infrastructure for the NHS.
Yeah. No, it's literally, I've been watching it late recently because I put chart alerts on, and it's been ticking down and hitting those alerts going further down. I thought, wow. And so it is one I'm just watching because you do get these companies, and they can have a really aggressive bounce when people realize they're oversold. And that's ridiculous. And people start piling in then. But that's the market, isn't it? You get this point where you can't avoid the opportunity sometimes, and you have to, you know, buy a couple of shares, you know, that silly price. But yeah, keep an eye on that. It's a good company and worth looking at massively.
You mentioned about sort of management, interesting management changes. Well, at Saieta, we've talked about that a few times, but they've had a management change this week. They've announced a new CEO coming in, an industry veteran who's spent the last sort of 6 years really, you know, deep diving and working in the decarbonisation and electrification field. So he's coming on board, a guy called David Woolley. And I mean, that what that says to me is you've got an industry veteran of 35 years who really knows what he's doing. He's kicked the tires. He's done due diligence on the company. He's obviously very impressed with the business and what it's trying to do and with its technology. And he wants to join and drive it forward. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of like reassurance that investors can, you know, take from that. Saieta is actually having its, I think it's got an AGM next week, and therefore their prelims should be coming out, or their FY23 results should be coming out fairly soon. It may not be before it, but it'll be certainly by the end of September. So, something for investors to watch out for. But I would say when you do get a top leadership change, then and you bring in a real industry, you know, heavyweight into the business, that does say a lot about the quality of the company, even though the shares may have sold off. And this is another one.
Yeah. I mean, they come down there. They keep hitting themselves at that 50 pence level. I think once you get above that, I think literally you can see here, it's a nice line, you know, even going from here, you can see, you know, higher lows there. And once it gets above 50, I think it's in an uptrend here. But
there's lots of big value catalysts coming there, because the production is just about to kick off in India with Padmini, with the V&A joint venture there. And once they start getting those e-drives off the production line into vehicles and into, you know, the public, into India, that'll just make a huge sentiment change for investors. It will go from being, you know, sort of like early stage to really sort of fast-tracking commercialization, because the EV vehicles and that industry in India is electric. Sorry.
Yeah. Hey. There's one here talking about, what do you say? Seems like Cakebox is a buy from your recent interviews and videos, Paul. Cakebox?
Yeah, I'm keeping my eye on it, no doubt about it. And, you know, they've had a bid on it at 160. It was rejected because it was too low. What's my view of the consumer? I mean, I'm not an expert in consumer. I don't do particularly well when it comes to investing, but it certainly seems as though people have normalized in terms of getting back to celebrating their birthdays. It's an affordable treat. And the product's fantastic. My family's used it twice. You know, you had got the big cake in for big parties, and it's great. So, yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, it's difficult to say, because I'm not an expert in that comfortable in Cakebox, but the franchise model, capital light, still growing, good margins on a cheap valuation with lots of cash and potential M&A interest. I mean, I'm not sure what isn't there to like there.
Yeah, and of course the main guy has a lot of skin in the game, doesn't he?
He does. Sukh Chamdal, yeah. So I wouldn't be throwing away that one. I mean, another one which is coming out with important news next week is Avintraz. They've got the prelims FY23. They just mopped up. Well, they bought the 82% of Adaptix that they didn't own. This is part of their sort of fledgling, fast-growing healthcare division. They've got, they're famous, obviously, for niche engineering with sort of blast-proof doors and nucleus safety storage boxes. But they've also got this healthcare business that's doing small-form MRI, but Adaptix does small-form X-rays. And they've got FDA approval. They're launching at the moment out in the States. Now they're 100% subsidiary of Avintraz. So I'm hoping to catch up with the guys there and try and dissect what they're doing with that. That could be a huge third growth platform for the business. And I think it will be, no doubt about it. They've got plenty of money so they can fund it. Really isn't an issue. It's going to come down to, again, execution. And I think what will happen, actually, small form MRI and small form, you know, X-ray, if you start seeing some significant sales, somebody's going to put a number on this division and buy it out at a big premium. And then they'll basically either reinvest that money or alternatively give it to shareholders. So these guys have been, you know, doing a great job for 20 years. The shares have, or certainly from the, you know, from the great 15 years or so, the great financial crisis, the shares have gone up by over 20% compound each year, which is just says everything. They know what they're doing. They're a really successful management team. And anyway, I wanted to highlight that to investors because, you know, if this one ever falls down, which it hasn't done in terms of, you know, being sold off because it's so high quality, you just got to fill your boots.
Yeah, since 2009, pretty much, 2010, it's an 1,200% in growth. And that's a weekly chart there. But that's quite impressive.
I think there's too many people. When it comes to sort of opportunities to buy this, I just think there's too many really smart investors who's on their shopping list. I'm pretty certain Christopher Mills at Harvard would want to increase his stake. James Thorne at Columbia probably would want to increase it. Never mind a whole bunch of other people who just see value as a potential upside for this business.
In fact, Steve says, Paul, if you get time, it would be great if you could do an interview with CEO Totally. Thanks for your comments.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, you know, there's always an invite. Wendy's a great lady. I love her.
Yeah. Sean has repeated. Just joined and missed. You can rewind. I think Sean is an avid fan of Avacta.
I think the big picture with Avacta, is that currently, you know, the Singers have a price target on a risk adjusted basis of 154. Yeah, if AVA 6000 gets to becomes to market, they'll take away that risk probability. And that will double the shares from their valuation to £3. Okay, that's just one drug in that precision platform. I mean, effectively, it's going to be the, who knows? You can never sell, but there's huge upside in this business, and I am now more confident about the safety and efficacy of the AVA 6000 and the precision platform than I have ever been, and I've been positive about it in the past.
Yeah.
But it's not without risk. When you scale up through the phases and trials and you go to a bigger population, you may, and they haven't seen it yet, you may have a blind spot. Nobody knows. Or there may be a hiccup, a delay, or whatever it is, because these things are not certain. So, you know, it's not something you could ever, ever say is a slam dunk, because they just don't exist.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it isn't. If you look at the stats in oncology going from, you know, preclinical to commercial, it's like, if you're including oncology, it's 13 to 1 chance.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if you put your money on a horse at 30 to 1, all your money on it, or you diversify a bit and say, oh, I'll keep a bit of money for other horses maybe. But so, yeah, but once you get past, phase 1, that goes down. But of course, it, that's an average, and some drugs are different to others. But and all you need is, like you say, it seems like an excellent product. Phase 1 is blown out of the water there. Really, it has. But like you say, when you get to sort of, you know, 1,000 people compared to, like, how much was in phase 1, do you know? How
many? It was 35 patients so far.
Yeah. When you get 1,000 people, all you need is one or two adverse events, and, you know, and that's...
Yeah, no, so, and then you can delay it until you prove that it isn't nothing to do with the drug. It's just because of that. I mean, the thing is to remember, these are really, really sick people. There's no alternative. Unfortunately, they don't get a treatment, and this, you know, they're going to die, and they know that, and that's why they're on the trial. Anyway, let's I don't know.
Any other news?
Yeah, well, another best in class company that is worth putting, you know, watching it, because they've been unfairly sold off in mine, is Supreme. Now, obviously there's been a lot of sort of controversy surrounding those whole sort of, like, you know, underage vaping and also disposables with the environmental side. Well, we've talked about it before, but Supreme not only has sort of best in class regulatory compliance in terms of, you know, going around spot checking some of the retailers for underage, making sure they're abiding by the rules, and checking that the ingredients and the content of all their products is right from the third party distributors. But also the key news is that they've now upped that on the regulatory compliance and being sort of really leading the industry as a thought leader in this. They're just about to launch their new reusable vaping pod, 88 vape, and this should certainly it leads the industry, because it basically, what it means is that, you know, you reduce the environmental footprint of this, the actual division.
Yeah,
and the trading's absolutely in line. So, you know, the shares have gone from about 130 to 90p. Or just over 90p on the back of that news, and that looks to me totally unfair. So I think there's an opportunity there.
Yeah,
I can't remember. I'll have to look at the PE, but I think it's roughly around. PE is less than 7.5. I mean, that is a joke for a business with cash on the balance sheet and growing, you know, a rate. So and is leading the market in. Effectively compliance and safety and underage, you know, all that kind of stuff, all the stuff that the government wants to do, they are leading the industry in it. You know, basically they're getting unfairly thrown out with the bathwater.
Yeah, I know that John and I talked about this a while back. So when you have a company that welcomes, you know, government, you know, backing support and open to chatting to the government, sort of supporting the negative side of it, that's good. And they said that they welcome that, you know. At the chart there, it is taking a bit of a hammer in it, but it is bouncing off after getting oversold down here. Like, that's a good buy at 70 pence, but it is bouncing off that 90 pence level. Even after that, in response to media, it's hitting that 90 pence and bouncing back up. Maybe it'll flatline and start building, who knows? But
you've got to remember that, you know, basically. The NHS is handing out 1 million vaping devices to get people off smoking. So it isn't as though this thing works. It's so much more, you know, helpful in terms of people's health, etc. So, you know, in that respect. And it's been demonstrated that vaping is twice as effective as any other form of, tobacco, of nicotine, to be able to get people off tobacco. So, you know, better than, twice as good as patches and gum and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that's why the NHS is using it. They wouldn't be doing it otherwise.
One of my stocks had some results out recently, Good Energy. And
how'd
it go? Well, it's good, but, you know, it popped up, but I think it's a little seller in there. I hold different stocks for different reasons. But I mean, you know, for example, Destiny Pharma there, I genuinely see is one of the best reward stocks. There's risk there, of course, because going through clinical trials. But as a risk reward, weighing up that, I think this is one of the best ratios here with Good Energy. Because I mean, if you look at the risk profile on it, I mean, here's the interim results. Now, it's a bit skewed to H1 because of payments for electricity support and all that stuff. But let's go to the market cap first. 32 million, okay? 32 million market cap. Keep that in mind. 32 million market cap, okay? Cash and equivalents of 34.9.
Okay, the question, Justin, on that one, okay, which that I don't know. A bit.
Yeah, go on.
The question is that distributable, or is it basically customers paying them deposits on a 12-month deal that bank that profit, and therefore that covers them buying the gas and electricity for their customers over the next 6 months?
Yeah, about 8 million of that is that, restricted cash, 8 million of that. So they have around about 19 million, but their net asset value, like I say, you know, people are not aware of that. If you broke the company down, sold it off bits, you should get about 50 million. And that's, and literally, the profit also went up in H1. They're going to be making a small loss in H2 due to the change in the margins and government support and all that stuff. But nevertheless, they will be profitable throughout the year. They're paying a dividend.
Question then. Okay, yeah, so 8 million of that 35 is effectively customer deposits, right?
Yeah.
Do they buy forward their energy?
Yes, they will buy. They've already hedged. I mean, they've about 90% hedged, I think.
Okay, and how much do they? How much do they need to post as collateral with the traders to be able to get the assurance of the that energy they're buying?
Well, I remember speaking to the CEO Nigel, and he said, "Really, we have about between 10 and 12 million in cash that we can do what we want with, and we're saving that for like acquisitions."
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, so what we're saying then is essentially, with is it 30 million market cap? You've got about million, you've got about their available cash. You've got over 10 million, a third of their effectively valuation, which is just they could distribute it if they want. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the revenue growth. This is my spreadsheet. I've done the price sales. It's the value here. They are now the only thing that's concerning is efficiency, the margins. But they are going to an energy services business. They're not going to be, you know, because there's no margin in supplying. If you own, you did own assets like wind farms, solar panels. There's a lot of, you know, capital expenditure with those. There's a lot of maintenance, and they had debt with that. So they sold those off. They now got power purchase agreements with Ørsted and also 1,800 independent energy suppliers. And go to the website. The lovely story about these suppliers from the Welsh hills, where the hydropower farmers, the husband and wife, got this little power unit or a solar farm attached to a winery in south of England, and they have 1,800 of those plus power purchase agreements. They supply that, but they've also acquired, you know, a solar business and a heat pump business. And I did say actually the heat pump business isn't growing as fast as we'd like yet, probably because the capital expenditure is quite expensive. Then Rishi came out with this rolling back, you know, the 2030 deal, and he's upped the amount they'll give you on a heat pump from 5,000 to 7,500. So that may even help them there. So, because it is quite a big spend, isn't it? A new boiler or whatever. So now you get £7,500 up front. But like I said, it's come down. Their biggest shareholder, like I said, offered £4 for them back here in 2021. It's still their biggest shareholder. But they did pop up, like I said, they're up to 220, which is quite nice. They're above that 200 moving average now, and these are curving up. So hopefully we'll see this going forward. But going forward, the margins improve, the top line comes down a little bit, not a lot, but you understand the margins improve a lot. And so I think the broker has a 475 target on it, and that's 7x EBITDA 2024. So, I just think it's going in the right direction. And regardless of where we've moved from 2030, 2035, it's inevitable, you know, we are going to a more clean, green environment. And just people in the end, well, I don't know what it is, but people will be driving more EVs and they will. And as I said, they own ZapMap as well, 49% of that. That's the most used, you know, charging point map app on the 80% of the market they've got in that. So it's just I quite like the space it's in. I quite like the valuation. I don't think it can go down a lot further compared to, unless they do something really stupid, because it's underpinned by the net asset value pretty much and the cash and the profitable pay a dividend, you know.
I'm with you. I actually think that whole sector is hugely sold off because it's no touch for many investors, given what happened at the start of the Ukraine-Russia war just before it. And as you know, energy prices ballooned, people lost faith. It's a bit like the contractor businesses, you know, with the likes of Galliford Try and all these other ones sort of a few years ago. Once you've got this sort of like, they're not sure, that don't fully understand the business model, then you get sentiment going off. So you're right, this is probably just unfairly sold off on sentiment.
So I just think it's one of the best risk reward plays out there, you know, because we often tend to look at everyone likes to look at the reward first, the risk.
Well, I mean, you know, we talked about it last time. I've had four profit warnings of late. I had Inspiration Healthcare, I had Essensys, and even Bristol Myers Squibb came out with a profit warning in the last results. But the big one was obviously Sondrel, and you know, they came out with their numbers actually today. The shares have been gone down a bit more, so they're about 15p. It's all to do, basically, going into next year. You know, you can just see it there.
The thing they worry about, I mean, is it the cash level they had?
Exactly. The cash level is very thin at the moment, should we say?
I'll go back to the chart.
I've got far more than that in my broker account. Never mind what they've got in the business.
Well, ask them, say, how much do you need? You
know, I know,
that's the thing sometimes, isn't it? You think, how much do you need? You know, let's have a whip round.
Okay, right. I did actually touch base quickly to the CEO this morning, right? And they have, it says in the statement, they've had 2.5 million. as a cash injection, well, basically a payment from one of their customers. It was delayed, so that's been that's come through. So they've got effectively about $2.5 million, you know, net cash at the half year now. If you said what I mean, but they had a cash burn in the first half of about $3.5 million, about sort of $600,000 a month, which means that they're going to be, you know, go back to be probably zero cash at the year end. Now, they have got some milestone payments coming in from a big OEM automotive, which hopefully should tide them through. And they've got some really positive sort of, you know, chip design contracts. Again, should be CC milestone payments and production. The problem they have, unfortunately, is if you have any delay in any of those cash flows coming into the business, you're going to get a bit of a hole in your bank and now in your bank account. And so I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, they've got certainly no intention of raising any money, as I understand. They don't need to because the cash flows are going to cover it. And they said that in the goings, the directors have, you know, vouched for that in the going concern statement. But if you do get delays, they probably haven't got too much amount of wiggle room. Now, what would be the, you know, the course if they do need more, you know, money? They might well better get vendor finance on some of their debt, because we're talking about the big customers here, you know, big OEMs who owe them money. And therefore, they might be able to get some, you know, some working capital trade finance on the back of it. That's fine. Lots of people do it. In the event that they can't do it, then you're probably looking at a convertible or alternatively, you know, an equity raise, one of the two. I can't see too many banks giving them a, you know, an RCF. You know, if you're not making profitable, but they should be profitable next year. That's what the brokers are saying. They should be profitable on the similar type of turnover for next year that they should have done this year. So coming big picture, yeah, it hasn't been my finest hour. Is probably a fair reflection.
Well, hang on a second. Let me just say one thing. And Sean, if you're still watching, he's a big fan of Avacta. He has most of his funds, if not all his funds, in Avacta. And I've said, shouldn't do that. Nothing's a dead cert in life, especially investments. But, and this is a lesson. So you've had three companies, what, within
four weeks.
But it don't matter, see, because look at this performer. You've had Equals bought in an excellent time. It's now taken up, what, a third of your portfolio. So when you understand that, let's say for example, you know, you have, you know, four companies you've gone, I don't know how big you went in those, but this is what, a double, triple your money on this. And yeah, so that's still, you know, like net,
well, let's go through Equals, right? You know, I started buying it.
I started
buying it just about 2.5 years ago. It was basically just after the pandemic hit. So around about, I think it was May, June time of 2020, okay? Mm-hmm. So I had an average buy price of roughly around about 27p or something like that, of that
nice
order.
Yeah, that's it, yeah, yeah.
So it was about that sort of level anyway, or 28p, I can't remember. I haven't sold a single share. They came out with their interims this you know, this last time. They've just done, you know, 43% like-for-like growth, top line. They've increased, importantly, their gross margins to 52%, and they've generated an enormous amount of cash. So this is a money-making machine. That is just in the UK as well. They've just bought this business in Belgium, and they'll take time to lift and shift their bank-grade technology over there into the EU, but next year again is going to be a huge inflection point. They could, the market opportunity in Europe is much bigger than it is in the UK, and they're winning effectively huge customers, large customers. That's what's really driving the growth, because of the effectively their bank grade technology, and you can see it happening again. You know, next year could be a really big moment. So, what do you do with somebody like, you know, with my holding? I've tripled my money, okay? Mm. My wife is losing sleep. My nerves are frayed.
The same reason. Why is she losing sleep? Oh, is she losing it? That's funny. Is she losing sleep over you, you know, because you've got such a big position in this?
Or yes.
Because you're getting a bit, you know.
Yes, spooky. Yes. Yes, so okay, to keep my marriage on the narrow, I've actually taken a third off. Okay, so I've top sliced. So okay, I've dropped my position from 30% of my portfolio to 20%. It's still the by far and away my biggest holding. I am still really positive on it, but now I'll be able to sleep a bit better at night and my wife will stop throwing rocks at me.
Yeah, so. No, I genuinely think when you're in that situation where a company whole, you know, takes up that size of your portfolio and you can't, you're always thinking about it and every movement you're looking at, it's not comfortable. You've got to ease up a little bit. And I think that's your brain and mind telling you, you need to unload a bit.
Exactly. It doesn't owe me anything at all now. The rest of go is running for free. And I am really positive on their business because the momentum top line is enormous. The opportunity is bigger than it's ever been. Their bank grade technology is best in class because, and the evidence you can see that is that they're winning so many large customers who want to now use the system. They just wouldn't be going with effectively equals. They'd be going with one of the large banks or one of the big players, the other big, sort of fintech providers, but they're not going with equals because they give them the best combination of value, service, and, geographical spread and speed of execution. So, they're doing really well.
I mean, I often walk the dog and listen to this sort of, the business podcast. I listened to Sky the other day, and Ian was on there.
I
know Ian myself, so he's on Sky, Business News. So they're doing really well there. You can't fault those triple digit, double digit,
But look at the gross margins they've gone up. So they're winning. They're winning market share, increasing their top line, but they're not actually seeing a degradation. They're not selling the product at a lower level. This isn't as though they're winning volume on lower prices. The gross margin's coming through. It's going positive. It's not even stable. It's going up. I mean, that's just amazing, isn't it? You hardly ever see that. If somebody's growing so much, they're usually having to give a better discount. But these guys, they're not. That's because the technology and the value proposition they offer is so compelling.
Yeah, but fair play. I mean, look at that. From July, it hit a pound. I thought we'd go higher. 2, 3, came back down to 80 pence. Then 4 shot up there. And then went down to 70 pence. Maybe it's time to get out of these now. And then all of a sudden, back up and popped through there and even come back down. So patience paid there, and it's gone back up again.
If I didn't hold 30%, if it was back, I wouldn't be selling them because
I'm actually holding them when they went down to 70 pence. Because when it gets to a quid, you're thinking, and drops to 70 pence, you think, bloody hell, I'm going to get out. that's good now. It's fair play. You did hold them.
Another one in that space, which is just worth mentioning, is Argentex. They showed top line like for like growth of 20%, and the market has sold the shares off. That's because there's some sort of level of skepticism whether they're going to hit their full year of 60 million revenue. I think they did 25 in the first half, so they need to do about 35 in the second half. They've had the whole market for sort of customer focused and tech enabled forex trade, payments and trading as services. They had it was a soft time over the summer in July and August, but they've started to see a stronger September, and of course there's a big Q4 coming up. Again, I think they are certainly something that is very, very cheap at the moment. I mean, I've got what is there? I think they're trading on it. I can't remember. It was about 12 times or something like 11.4 times PE with plenty of cash in the bank. And I interviewed all the guys, and they're very confident that the business is moving in the right direction, driven by growth, organic for customers. They're winning market share against the major banks, and their tech-enabled platform that really is accelerating and increasing a share of wallet to those customers. And then obviously they've got geographical expansion out in Europe as well. So there's all systems go for that business. It's been unfairly sold off, and I think again, if they can deliver their numbers, the execution side, then 2024 will be a really strong period for them.
Yeah, yeah, look at that little gap there. It's amazing how it comes back to that. It's almost like a magnet. So it gapped. Do you remember that trading update? I bought a few of that down here, and I wanted to buy more, and they came up with a trading update that literally gapped up. Then, oh, my word. They did come back a bit, and I bought some more then. And then I did come out here. They started rolling over, I think. But it's come back to that level, and I thought,
yeah, I know. It's good. It's nuts, isn't it?
The sentiment's down a little bit, and the momentum's against them. But that, like I said, you know, fundamentally, if the business is improving, then that's an opportunity, you know.
You see it a lot with AIM shares, because we're still not, I mean, it comes down to what we talked about, you know, first off, if you have UK interest rates now start of top line, they're flattened out, plus they're actually, you know, going to come down maybe, you know, sort of, you know, say first half of next year, that's going to be a huge, you know, sort of like potential catalyst for all small companies, because you're going to see multiple expansion. You may not see earnings, you know, increasing more than their current expectations, but you don't need that. If you just get back to a normal level of, you know, valuation multiple, then that will really drive it up. And this one, I mean, it's crazily at 11 times, given the strong, you know, 20% top line growth, you know, static, you know, good strong margins, generating lots of cash. That's just crazy. 11 times. Yeah. I mean, you're just joking. You know, it's a crazy valuation.
Yeah. Cool stuff. All right. Anything else, Paulie Paul?
No, I think that's probably about it. Okay. Any more questions at all we can come in through?
Look,
Anything on intelligent ultrasound at all?
Well, has it moved? Let's have a look. Let's look at the chart. Someone did say, actually, about Cornerstone, which is...
That's a competitor. It's a very small version of Equals. Yeah. All I would say is that it is definitely interesting, because I've had a quick look at it. It isn't profitable yet, you know, I've got so much money in that sector through Equals, but also I've got PayPal as well. I'm just not going to put another one in my portfolio on fintech payments. No chance.
Yeah, well, I wasn't. I think a guy who worked at Equals, it now works here, doesn't it? Cornerstone.
Yeah, that's.
I think,
Yes, I think you might do, actually. I think you're right.
Someone said them before. But it's looking quite good at the moment. It's coming down, breaking the trend, it's breaking up. So there we are. But intelligent ultrasound, no, it hasn't gone anywhere. It's gone down a little bit. Come on, people. Can't you see what's happening here?
Well, actually, one company I do own that came out with an inline trading update is Alico, which is worth, you know, okay, that built tech platform. I think that's another one that people should have a look at. You know, Alico. It's basically reached another one with an inflection point. I can really see this one doing well next year in 2024. It's got lots of cash in the balance sheet. You can't see the growth.
I like that chart.
You can't see the growth because they're transitioning to the SaaS model. But if you looked at it on a like for like basis from sort of perpetual licenses and SaaS and kept them the same, they'd be doing probably, I'm just guessing here, probably low double digit type growth, certainly high single digit organic growth. And therefore on that basis, this should be sort of 3 to 4 times sales revenues. Yeah. Cause effectively you're selling software, you're selling air. And they should be a big beneficiary of AI as well, because you'll incorporate it in a better service to be able to improve the product for customers. Plus you'll be able to reduce your cost base because it will accelerate all your software development. So they're really in a good, strong position, in my view. They're currently trading at about 2 times sales, I think. So I could see, my price target's 130 on this one. I've held this, as I say, from 2015, so through thick and thin. And it hasn't reached 30% of my portfolio, so I haven't had that problem we've had with Equals. But it's another good quality stock.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not, a downtrend has ended there. I mean, it downtrend down the low of like 61 pence. But you can see it's bounced up a couple of higher lows here. It wants to break that 84 pence. And once it does, though, that's the resistance. It'll move higher, you know. So it's looking
good. And if you do see interest rates coming down, you will see a lot of their customers starting to, you know, to do more infrastructure, to do more build, et cetera, to move to project management. So, yeah, I mean, you know, hey, who knows? There's nothing's without risk, put it that way. But it's got lots of cash, and it's growing, and it's got high margins, and it could well be bought by somebody. It wouldn't surprise me either.
Okay. Marvellous stuff. Anything else?
No, that's it. That's great, yeah.
Okay, in a couple of weeks' time, Paul, if there's results out in the company that I've taken a small position on, right, but I think this could be the real deal.
Okay, nice one.
I'm looking around and I read about it, and the sector it's in, what it's doing, it's very special because when I look for companies, first of all, size, it's got to be a small cap, micro cap to move up. But it has got scale. Is the sector it's in growing very quickly, and does it have something special? And this company does. And literally, I think it's growing very quickly, but it's not very well known at all. But in a couple weeks' time, I'm hopefully
reveal it. Okay. Well, we've got lots of good news coming after the next 2 weeks, and that's going to be top of the agenda. Yeah. That is.
No. Let me mention that. I say it's equals. It's a very good company. No, it's not equals. It's smaller than equals. But it's very exciting. Cool. Yeah. Hopefully, they've got some results out in a week or so time, and if that looks good, then we'll see from that. And I may take a bigger position. But there we are. Cool. Thanks, everyone. And join us in a couple of weeks live. Thanks for leaving comments. And don't forget to hit that subscribe button, like it, share it if you like what we're doing here. And we'll do it again sometime. Well, in fact, 2 weeks. Cheers, Paul.
Thanks, guys.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.